I'm worried that, you know, he became disoriented and either headed out onto the ice or headed into, you know, inland.
A search broadens for a man lost near Nome. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 29th of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, reaction to Joe Miller's possible court plans.
So procedurally, it's been very complicated, largely because the way that Mr. Miller decided to sue first in federal court.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Penn Air, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at pennair.com. And by Alaska Business Monthly, providing a source for statewide in-depth business news on Twitter at AK Business Month or Facebook.
Search and rescue crews from Nome and Teller are continuing the search for John Kizuna. The Rescue Coordination Center is dispatching an aircraft today, and planes from State Troopers Fish and Game and the Fish and Wildlife Service will also be used in the aerial efforts. From Nome, KNOM's Ben Matheson has more.
Ground storms have limited the visibility, and wind chills dipping to 50 degrees below zero have slowed ground search efforts. Trooper Jonathan Strobel says that the search area is very large at this point, spanning the 40 miles from Woolly Lagoon to Nome.
It's pretty broad right now because, you know, he had a week head start on us. You know, we didn't even know he was missing or overdue until a week after he departed. So the search area is pretty big right now, especially due to the blizzards. I'm worried that, you know, he became disoriented and either headed out onto the ice or headed into, you know, inland. You know, maybe up a drainage or river valley or something like that. So that's why air assets are becoming employed right now.
55-year-old Kizuna had been staying at a cabin near Woolly Lagoon. Family members went to check on him Monday and found a note dated December 20th saying that he was walking to Nome. Trooper Strobel says Kizuna has outdoor experience, but the circumstances of his departure are still unclear.
I've heard that he walks to Teller to do his laundry, you know, from Woolly Lagoon. So it sounds like he's got some pretty good experience. However, I don't know what kind of survival gear provisions he had with him. So, you know, if he was stuck out in a blizzard, I don't know, you know, if he was able to find or make a shelter or if he became disoriented and lost and, you know, he doesn't have any resources with him. We just don't know that at this point.
Jim West Jr. from Nome Search and Rescue says they are considering the possibility of making a camp near Woolly Lagoon and staging ground search efforts from there. West says a team from Teller searched the area between Woolly Lagoon and Teller. With the possibility of Kizuna being underneath the snow, crews are looking into equipment to remotely detect body heat, but they have not yet secured the equipment. From KNOM in Nome, I'm Ben Matheson.
U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski will be sworn in as Alaska senator come January. According to the state, the results of Murkowski's race with Joe Miller for the seat were certified yesterday by the State Division of Elections. Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell.
Director of Elections Gail Fanumi, has permission to certify the election. She certified it, and we certified it with a final vote count with Lisa Murkowski with 101,091 votes. And Joe Miller with 90,839 votes. Later this week, Governor Parnell and I will sign a piece of paperwork required by the U.S. Senate Clerk's Office, and we'll get that to Washington before noon on Monday. And Senator Murkowski will be able to continue her service without loss of seniority.
Governor Parnell will officially sign certification papers for U.S. Senate tomorrow. U.S. District Court Judge Ralph Beislein ruled on Joe Miller's suit against the State Division of Elections yesterday, dismissing Miller's challenge to the results of the November 2nd election and upholding a prior appeals decision by the Alaska Supreme Court. In his ruling, Beislein said that he did agree with Miller on one point, and that was the varying interpretation of the state statute regarding the manner in which U.S. Senate elections are to be conducted. Although Beislein upheld the interpretation of the statute by the Alaska Supreme Court, he wrote that it was poorly drafted and suggested the Alaska legislature should act to clarify it. Treadwell says when the legislative session begins, the Elections Division will move on that advice.
We're very happy to work with the legislature to revise Alaska election law as needed, and I expect that when this is all over, we will do a review of the law, how the election went, and what were the points of controversy. We'll work on that with the Department of Law, make some recommendations to Governor Parnell, and if the administration decides to put forward some changes, we will. I've also told the committee chairman in the House and the Senate that we're very happy to work with them if they do a review.
The governor's certification of the election must be received in Washington, D.C. by January 3rd. Miller said today he plans to announce by Friday whether he'll continue his legal fight over the Alaska Senate race. Miller spokesman Randy DeSoto says he is weighing his options. Miller can appeal Tuesday's federal court decision. He has said he's willing to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, but is taking legal steps one at a time. Anchorage attorney Tim McKeever says Miller faces an uphill battle to get his appeal heard. McKeever is one of the lawyers who represented Senator Lisa Murkowski in the election litigation. He says there is strong preference in federal law to allow state courts to decide issues of state law. In this case, the state Superior Court and the Alaska Supreme Court ruled against Miller, as did federal district judge Ralph Beislein.
Judge Beislein has indicated that he defers to the state Supreme Court's interpretation of the law. The Ninth Circuit is likely to do the same thing. If the case were to go to the Ninth Circuit or the Supreme Court, both of those levels are likely to do the same thing. The Supreme Court is not likely to overturn a decision by the highest court in the state, and that's essentially what Mr. Miller would be asking them to do.
McKeever says there does not now appear to be any remaining challenges that could block Murkowski from being certified.
Senator Murkowski, assuming that the certification process that the state's doing will go ahead as scheduled tomorrow afternoon, is going to be sworn in as a senator on Wednesday of next week for the next term. She will be in the Senate, and it's very unlikely that a court would decide that for some reason she should not remain in the Senate.
McKeever says other states have dealt with write-in ballot and voter intent concerns, but he says Miller's case was unusually complicated because he initially filed in federal court to address state issues.
So the federal court deferred to the state courts. The state courts considered this matter very quickly. The Alaska Supreme Court ruled. Mr. Miller went back to the federal court and has raised other issues. So procedurally, it's been very complicated, largely because the way that Mr. Miller decided to sue first in federal court.
Along the way, Miller attempted to raise other concerns that he alleged were examples of possible fraudulent voting or a lack of proper oversight in security as ballots moved from the state to the precincts and back. But McKeever says the state has a comprehensive system in place to monitor and secure the ballots from printing to counting.
At the end of the election, there's a state review board that goes through the process and examines the returns from all of the various precincts, determines sort of whether the processes were followed, whether the precinct registers correspond to the number of ballots that were counted in that precinct and whatnot. And the state does a very thorough job of verifying the accuracy of the count and verifying the integrity of the process. And so given that fact, I think it's unlikely that there was any kind of shenanigans with the ballots. The allegations that Mr. Miller makes really are not supported by the evidence.
McKeever says although Miller has the right to appeal to the Ninth Circuit, he thinks overturning the current decision is unlikely.
I think that the facts are that Alaskans voted. Senator Murkowski won that election. There's no suggestion that there was any significant problems with the way the election was conducted. The election should be over, and Alaskans should be able to move on.
The village of Savunga on St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea is continuing to struggle with power outages. The Alaska Division of Homeland Security says the power outages began Monday when lines became laden with ice and winds caused arcing. Electrical technicians have been able to restore power to the new section of town and most of the old section, but about 25 homes and the village store remained without power today. Phone communication also has been affected and some pipes are frozen. Homeland Security spokesman Jeremy Zedek says at one point about 90% of the homes were without power. He says some people are staying at the school. About 700 people live in Savunga. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska actors talk about the upcoming Whales movie.
You know, I was just like staring at her and I was thinking, John, quit staring at Drew, quit staring at her.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Alaska Congressman Don Young has been named chairman of the Subcommittee on Indian and Alaska Native Affairs, a newly established subcommittee under the House Natural Resources Committee. Oversight and legislative responsibility for Indian and Alaska Native matters were previously handled by the full committee. Young says he's honored to be the new chair of the subcommittee. Earlier this month, Begich Middle School teacher Scott McKinn went before the Anchorage School Board to get its support for a school wind turbine project. With the board's unanimous approval, and on the last day before the holiday break, McKinn and his students went before another group with their wind turbine project, the Muldoon neighborhood. KSKA's Len Anderson attended.
We're hosting an open house to tell the public about our proposed wind turbine project and also solicit feedback and comments.
Applied science teacher Scott McKinn explains the Thursday evening event as he walks across the Begich multipurpose room. To the right is a table with three fans powering model windmills wired to watt meters, each indicating the wind-generated power.
We're trying to showcase what the students have done in the classroom. There's a very big curriculum connection to this project. We just don't want this to be a project that stands by itself out on the lawn here. It's a perfect project. It involves science, technology, engineering, math. So the projects we just walked by here, students designed wind turbine blades. We went over the physics of wind turbine blades. It also follows a scientific process.
The audience is mostly Muldoon residents. In order to get city approval, the school, in this case the teacher and students, must contact some 24 adjacent neighbors and they hope get them to accept the project. About 20 students holding scripts arrange themselves across the stage. They're members of the PACE Club, the group actually doing the wind turbine project. PACE stands for Planning Academic Career Excellence. Following a short introduction from McKinn, they begin their presentations.
We are well suited both here in Anchorage and in regard to the national energy picture to develop wind power. The U.S. Department of Education has recognized the importance of renewable
energy.
Audience
questions fill a half hour. They include concerns about possible bird fatalities, unlikely, students climbing the tower, also unlikely, and unsightliness. The Begich wind turbine would actually be shorter than the cell phone tower across DeBar Road. Earlier, student Michaela Winters had discussed construction cost.
Our wind turbine project will be funded through a variety of sources and to no cost to you. Legislative grant, discounted hardware through Alaska Wind for Schools program, schools fundraising, for example, hooded sweatshirts, and in-kind donation from SERI.
Much of the funding for teaching alternative energy options came from a federal Department of Energy grant. When the turbine is raised and functioning, the school district would cover the annual maintenance. Joaquin Monterosa explained how much power will be produced.
Last year, our school alone spent about $14,000 a month on our electricity bill. With our new wind turbine, it's mostly for educational purposes, but it will probably power about 3 or 4 computers.
McKinn regarded the evening as an educational success, not only because of the student presentations, but also the audience participation. He noted the neighbors were an important element of the project.
The civic part of it, and the civic engagement, and connecting with the public about what we feel is a very relevant and yet complex issue about energy here in Anchorage and Alaska and the country.
The students will now seek Anchorage Assembly approval. The project began about a year ago, with the turbine raising scheduled for the summer of 2011. The most likely site is just behind the Nicholas Begich Middle School sign that faces DeBar Road. The Begich Middle School turbine will not be the first. Sherwood Elementary School in Palmer already has a small wind turbine. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. And by Penn Air, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at pennair.com.
In the 3 years since Sheldon Jackson College in Sitka closed, there's been much attention directed at the efforts to settle the school's debts while leaving something behind for a future institution. That legacy will not include a library. Earlier this year, Sheldon Jackson trustees announced that the Stratton Library will be sold to the state. But only the building is going to the state. The future of the books inside is a different story. As KCAW's Robert Woolsey tells us, local librarians have been working hard to redistribute the most valuable items, and earlier this month gave the public a chance to buy books right off the shelf.
Have they done these?
I don't want to disrespect the collection because it's a phenomenal collection. But it's a collection without a home.
Ginny Blackson was Sheldon Jackson College's last librarian. She knows down to the last Dewey decimal point what's in this building.
48,000 individual books, most of which are part of a general liberal arts academic collection.
I'm Stephanie Ask. I've got a ton of good stuff. I filled up 2 huge boxes, actually. I'm trying to escape now before I get more.
What are you looking for, mainly?
In particular, I'm looking for books that I can use in my classroom, and I also found some really good plays that maybe we can use. I'm just amazed that I can get these books in such high quality condition for such an incredibly cheap price. I mean, there have been some really great steals here.
Stephanie Ask teaches English and theater at Sitka High School. It's interesting that several boxes of Stratton books are headed to her classroom, since that's pretty much where they came from. For most of Sheldon Jackson's 129-year history, books were stored in the school's classrooms. Stratton was built in 1974, and the collection assembled by Dr. Evelyn Bonner under the Library of Congress cataloging system. Her disapproving glower seems to haunt this sale for those of us who remember her. Breaking up a library is a difficult undertaking on many fronts.
My name is Bill Davis, and I'm shopping primarily for Alaskana stuff. To tell you the truth, I'm looking also for Nancy's studies that she donated to the library a long time ago, of which we found 1 or 2. Some are missing.
Davis and his wife, Nancy Yaw Davis, are uncharacteristically somber today. Nancy is a published academic anthropologist. Her father, Leslie Yaw, was president of Sheldon Jackson during what will probably become known as its heyday in the middle of the last century.
That's an emotional tie that's one that you can try to get some distance from, but it's not easy. It's kind of a heart-wrenching experience to walk into a library and see all these wonderful resources and wonder what's going to happen to them.
For many close to the college, the eventual disposal of the Stratton collection has loomed large. Ginny Blackson, who now works at Sitka High School, and other members of the Sitka Library Association have worked relentlessly to ensure that irreplaceable materials have been protected. Blackson, in fact, within 2 weeks of the school's closure, made arrangements to loan the National Park Service 850 glass plate negatives taken by the early Alaskan photographer E.W. Merrill. The Park Service likely will purchase the plates. Likewise, an extensive collection of early 20th century Alaskana, collected by customs agent C.L. Andrews, has been given to Sitka's Kettleson Library. Stratton's theological collection has been shipped out to Alaska Christian College in Soldotna, which has just constructed a new library. The Sitka tribe took 12 shelves full of Stratton's Native American collection for their new library. Most of this work of boxing and shipping the various collections was funded by a state resources rescue grant. What's left at Stratton could be called the best of the rest, but for many shoppers like Trista Patterson, Browsing in a library and browsing in a bookstore are worlds apart.
How you put a value on a library is nothing that I can really even wrap my brain around. So what I was looking for was just the experience. And then you get inside and you see, you know, Louise May Alcott and Thoreau and all of these incredible, unique pieces of work from Native history and Alaskan history.
Patterson is an academic and economist. She's not happy to see a library collection, a part of the commons, privatized. On the one hand, she thinks it reflects our times. On the other, it's better than the alternative.
I wouldn't want any of these books to get wasted in any way. So if they can go to great people that will really appreciate them, then all the better.
Around 30,000 books remain in Stratton. The Sitka Library Association plans at least one more sale before the building is transferred to the state. I'm Robert Woolsey.
Yes, so you guys are
the movie production Everybody Loves Whales has received a lot of attention in Alaska for actually being shot in Alaska. The film is based on an incident in 1988 when three gray whales became trapped in sea ice near Barrow. When Alaskans go to the movie, one thing they'll be watching for is how they're portrayed. Shane Iverson from KYUK in Bethel spoke to the Alaskan actors in the film to see what it was like to be part of the production and to find out what they think it could mean for the state's First Peoples.
It's not the first time Hollywood's rolled into Alaska, but it's been a while. It was 1994 when Steven Seagal used his Aikido skills to serve up his version of Native justice in the political action movie On Deadly Ground.
Well, let's see, that's Natives 8 and Oil Workers 0. Anybody else want to play with Cupcake?
In the movie, Seagal plays the hero, beating up on villainous oil company workers in a crusade to protect a vaguely defined but totally defenseless Eskimo village.
They're speaking Yupik in the movie, but then there's a few other languages that are thrown in there that people can't quite recognize.
Don Reardon is a UAF professor and author of the upcoming book, The Raven's Gift. He shows On Deadly Ground to his writing class, many of whom are Yupik, Chupik, or Inupiaq Eskimos.
They're offended by what they see on film when they start to realize that that's them being misrepresented to the world as backwards and unsophisticated and in many respects complete buffoons.
The lead Eskimo character in the film was Seagal's romantic interest, Masu. The actress that played Masu is Chong Chen, a Chinese-born actress.
In you, I've seen a great spirit.
This has been happening since the beginning of film. You know, like, On Deadly Ground isn't the only movie that does that. It's back in even the Charlie Chaplin days. And those stereotypes, they've just been perpetuated, you know, until today.
I'm a hunter, and I will forever say... That's what I am. That's who I am. I'm a hunter.
Enter John Chase, a 35-year-old Yupik Eskimo cast to play Roy, the whaling captain.
Got to Anchorage, and they said, John, your first scene is with Drew Barrymore, your big scene. And I was kind of taken off guard. I was like, holy cow, this is crazy.
Chase is a Yupik dancer and drummer, so he's performed before, but never as an actor.
This room was packed. That made the intensity level of the scene, like, so much more, because it wasn't just me and Drew and, you know, a couple dozen people. That I thought there was over 100 people in there.
Movie makers found Chase in a series of open auditions held in Anchorage and other communities in Eskimo-populated hubs around the state. The reach of those auditions were unprecedented, and Chase says Alaskans will be able to see the success of that on the big screen.
I'm just so glad that this movie has real people portraying the real people, you know, real Inupiaq and Yupik people playing real people.
Chase himself is originally from Bethel with familial ties to the village of Nunapichuk.
You know, there's folks from all over, Point Hope, Shaktuluk, Point Lay, Inuksit, Anchorage, Kotzebue, Barrow, Chivak.
One actor from Chivak is John Pingayak. He's heard here performing at the Chamai Dance Festival in Bethel.
A lot of people that have experience have told me, you know, you got to act who you are so that the experience that I have in the past, like hunting experience that I've grown up with, lifestyle. It was part of my portrayal in this movie as being an Inupiaq elder.
Pingayak himself is a young Chupik elder. He speaks Chupik, which is part of the Eskimo family of languages, but it's distinct from Inupiaq, the language of the character Pingayak plays. He says to try and reconcile the two, he'd get coaching from the other actors and extras on set.
I would go to that Inupiaq guy and say, hey, what was I supposed to say? And they'll tell me right there. They're very helpful. I tell you, those Inupiaq people were always sharing. They're always giving.
He hopes that shared experience will help to authenticate the movie when it hits the big screen. The stars in the movie could help make sure at least hundreds of thousands and possibly millions of people see the movie. Chase himself felt the gravity of Barrymore's star power when he first met her.
The good thing is I didn't have to talk, because he was doing all the talking and I was just like staring at her and I was thinking, John, quit staring at Drew, quit staring at her. No, but I couldn't help it, you know, because she's a megastar.
Despite the status, though, Pingayak says it was comfortable working with all of the well-known actors.
These people are very down-to-earth people, and, you know, they were side-by-side with us native actors.
And for Pingayak, that was an eye-opener.
To me, it was like opening the doors for our people from all over Alaska to be part of the movie, and also opening the doors for other movies to come in and have respect for our people and where they came from, and also as well as who they are.
For author and professor Don Reardon, he hopes Everybody Loves Whales will be a turning point. He hopes the depiction of Eskimos will be more accurate than other Hollywood movies.
But I don't think that anything will change until Alaskans are actually making the movies. I hope I'm wrong.
And so might the actor, Chase. In real life, he's made hundreds of kills, but none of them whale. He hopes his Inupiaq brothers and sisters find his portrayal believable.
I just hope that that my portrayal of this character, Roy, is up to their standards.
Everybody Loves Whales is scheduled to be released in 2012. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Nome, Ellen Lockyer and Len Anderson in Anchorage, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Shane Iverson in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. It's almost time to file online for your PFD, and when you do, you can make an impact by sharing just a little with a cause you care about. Celebrate the arts, invest in education, shelter a homeless pet, lend a hand, or even make a wish come true when you pick, click, give to one of Alaska's nonprofits. Visit pickclickgive.org to decide how you will make Alaska better with a small gift from your PFD. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.